That seems to be working. All right, so I want to describe to you the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory and also the new laboratory that we are just about to open at the same location, 2 kilometers underground in INCO's Creighton Mine near Sudbury, Ontario. We're studying a variety of things that relate to neutrinos and dark matter and neutrinos double beta decay and a variety of topics that have different interactions with the topics of this conference. I will start off by telling you about the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory and in particular some new results that went on the archive at 8 o'clock last evening from the final phase of snow. You'll understand what I mean by phases in a moment. And then I'll go on to describe to you the underground laboratory. This is the snow detector, and this is the underground laboratory, including the snow detector, and a new area which expands our total excavated underground region by to a total of a factor of 3. The snow detector uses $330 million worth of heavy water that we got on loan for a buck from Canada's reserves, and we were able to use that heavy water to do some unique measurements of solar neutrinos that I'll tell you about in a moment. The objective was to try to understand what had come to be known as the solar neutrino problem. That is the fact that whereas the theory, particularly, the theory, particularly as pursued by John McCall and his co-workers, was rather specific about the numbers of neutrinos from various neutrino-producing reactions in the sun. And experiments that, starting with the pioneering experiments of Davis with chlorine and Koshiba and his co-workers with water in the Kamioka mine, found that in comparison to the various contributions that you get from these different reactions with different thresholds for the different experiments, which are represented by the color bars that you see here, the experiments, which are the blue bars, were all factors of 2 or 3 lower than what was being observed. And so snow with the heavy water was designed to observe separately the electron neutrinos produced in the sun and also a reaction which was equally sensitive to all neutrino types in order to try to determine whether the explanation for these low numbers was that the electron neutrinos were changing into another flavor or whether it was simply the fact that these calculations should have been down here matching the experiments. By having heavy water, we were able to look at several rather specific reactions that enabled us to do this. The first is a reaction in which the electron neutrinos produce a transition from a neutron to a fast-moving electron and a proton in the deuterium nucleus, giving you, from the fast-moving electron, Cherenkov light in the heavy water. And that is specific to electron neutrinos. We were also able to observe a second reaction, which is equally sensitive to all neutrino types, all active neutrino types, which essentially breaks deuterium into a neutron and a proton, and the neutrino, of course, goes off and is undetectable. There are 3 different ways in which we were able to detect the presence of this neutron, and therefore a signature for this reaction, and those are the 3 phases of the experiment that I'll refer to. In addition to that, there's a third reaction, which is also the sort of thing you observe in light water, which is the elastic scattering of any neutrino type from the electrons. Turns out that you are about 6 times more sensitive to electron neutrinos than other neutrino types in that reaction. And that's why the measurements that were made with the water in the past were largely measurements of electron neutrinos. So by comparing these 2 reactions, you can get the ratio of electron neutrinos to all neutrinos. You can see whether that ratio is in fact different from 1. And if it is, then it's a clear indication of a neutrino flavor change for solar neutrinos. And therefore, you'll see me referring to the CC to NC ratio as I talk about the future data. It is the ratio of those two fluxes that I'll be talking about. So the three techniques that we used to observe those free neutrons produced in the heavy water, for the first phase of the experiment over this period, we observed the 6.25 MeV gamma ray produced when the deuterium recaptures that neutron. And that gamma ray produces light in our detector, which we detect along with the Cherenkov light. In that particular phase of the experiment, we were not able to distinguish neutral current and charge current reactions. But by comparing what we observed with what you would observe if there were different ratios of charge current to neutral current, we were able to show conclusively that, in fact, only about one-third of the electron neutrinos survive in reaching our detector. In the second phase, which took place in this period, we added chlorine to the water and then produced, when the neutron captures, a cascade of gamma rays with a higher energy and therefore more easy to detect, but also far more isotropic in terms of how the event projects on the light sensors, and therefore distinguishable from the Cherenkov cone that is produced from the charge current reaction. And therefore, it was possible to separate the neutral current and charge current reactions and get independent measurements of the two fluxes, the fluxes detected by the two techniques, and therefore independent measurement of electron neutrinos and all neutrino types. And that was in agreement with what we saw in the first case. And finally, what I'll tell you about today is what we have just published, which is a further completely independent measurement of the neutral current reaction rate by putting in an array of detectors that have helium-3 in them and enable you in this array, which is about 400 meters long inside our detector, you can detect that neutron from production of the neutral current reaction uniquely and separate it from the light output that's observed in the remainder of the detector. Now, this is what the detector looks like. It has in the central region here the heavy water and ultimately the array of helium-3 detectors. The heavy water is about 1,000 tons. This is roughly the size of a 10-story building, and it's built at a location which is 2 kilometers underground. All of the detector had to be cut into parts that would fit in the mine cage and taken down individually and reassembled. And it was all done in a ultra-clean environment. Everybody that worked there once we sealed the walls took a shower and wore clean room clothing so that we were able to restrict the radioactivity in that detector such that reaction that we are attempting to detect, where there's a free neutron in the heavy water, has essentially no competition from radioactivity breaking apart deuterium and producing a free neutron. And we were able to do that so that the background from radioactivity was a factor of 10 less than what our signal was, and was also determined within about a factor of 30, but had an uncertainty of about 30%. So all of this care resulted in basically an experiment where we could observe neutrinos above a given threshold energy and essentially no background in the affecting us. And so we could make a very clean measurement in each of these two phases. By the way, there's this heavy water. It's looked at by an array of about 10,000 phototubes looking in. And all of this is immersed in a total of 7,000 tons of ultra-pure light water inside a sealed cavity. It's about 34 meters from bottom to top there. The results of those first experiments were that the charge current reaction in units of 10 to the sixth was about 1.6. The neutral current reaction, representative of all three neutrino types, was about 3 times that. And so that ratio indicated that electron neutrinos are really only about one-third of the total, with a very clean, by now about 7 standard deviation indication that neutrinos are changing their flavor. What this plot shows you is a plot where you deal with electron neutrino flux on this axis, mu and tau neutrino on this axis. The charge current reaction in red here is vertical. The neutral current reaction will be a function of all three types, and they intersect in this region. If you then take the elastic scattering reaction as measured by Super-Chemeucanda with electrons in light water or snow with electrons in heavy water, then you find these black and green bands which intersect very well. But in fact, snow alone can give you more than 7 standard deviation in indicating that neutrinos change their flavor. Of course, by measuring all three neutrino types, you are also measuring the total flux of neutrinos that left the sun. And those are in excellent agreement now, excellent agreement with solar model theories for boron-8 neutrinos. In fact, they're more accurate than the theory. If you now interpret this in terms of the oscillation of massive active neutrinos, and now we now have no evidence for anything other than 3 active neutrinos involved in the measurements that have been made to date. Recently, the LSND results have been ruled out by a mini-Boone experiment. But if you say that you have massive neutrinos and you express the flavor eigenstates in terms of the mass eigenstates, 1, 2, and 3, then you find that this matrix can be broken down into parts that are representative of, respectively, solar and reactor, and we have finite results for both of those defining these mixing parameters. Camland experiment has observed parameters that are very similar to what we observed for solar neutrinos. Of course, prior to that, there had been very nice evidence for muon neutrinos changing their flavor as they traverse the Earth, muon neutrinos produced in the atmosphere. And so in both of these cases, we have finite results for these mixing angles and for the difference in mass, 1, 2, and 2, 3. For the future, we have only a limit on this parameter. What we would ultimately like to do is to understand the CP-violating phases that come up in this particular sector for the leptons. This is of interest because of potential leptogenesis effects. There's another way to get at this problem. From here to the left, you're dealing with neutrino oscillations. That's the effects you get. If you go to double beta decay, then you have the whole matrix, same parameters otherwise. This is neutrinoless double beta decay with 2 other phases that we would like to determine. All of these processes could be related to CP violation in the early universe or leptogenesis. If you have a very intense or a very dense electron medium through which the electrons are moving, then you have an additional effect that can take place in terms of this flavor transformation associated with the extra interactions you get for electron neutrinos only. And that perturbs these equations in such a way that you have an energy-dependent effect. You can get a distortion in the sun as the neutrinos go through the sun and interact with the electrons. You could also get regeneration in the Earth, so you could have a difference in the day and night. If this does take place, if you can show that, in fact, you are having matter interaction, then you can determine the relative sign of 1 and 2 in that set of equations I was showing you. And that's an interesting question as you try to now understand how neutrinos fit into theories that extend the standard model. So if you take that formalism and take the data that's been obtained from snow and also that previous solar data, then what you find is that the region that is allowed is very small in these 2 parameters you're dealing with, delta m squared and theta. In this case, it's a 2 neutrino type analysis because you can break up that 3 neutrino analysis into different two neutrino sensitivities and with very little interaction between them. And what you find is that there is a region of interaction which is consistent with matter interactions and defines a rather restricted phase space of these two parameters. The mass interactions take place in such a way that mass one is greater than mass two. And what you find is that with this charge current to neutral current flux, you are also defining this angle very well. That's what we have the best sensitivity to in SNOW. And in fact, that angle is less, the tan of it is less than one, clearly by more than five standard deviations. So again, as you try to look at theories that go beyond the standard model, you're now getting accuracy in terms of how you define the parameters of those theories. In addition, it's consistent with a very small day-night effect and very small spectral distortion as observed both with SNOW and Super-Chem-Ukanda. If you add those reactor neutrino results from CAMLAND that I mentioned, then you restrict primarily in the vertical axis. That's what they get sensitivity to. What you find is that the parameters that work for these reactor experiments are essentially the same region of parameters for neutrino delta M squared and theta as you find for matter interactions in the sun, even though there's no matter interactions in the reactor neutrino measurements. And so that's a rather nice confirmation of universal neutrino parameters working in both cases. CAMLAND has recently come out with another measurement which will restrict even more in this vertical direction. We haven't yet been able to incorporate that in our analyses, but it means that what I'll show you today can be even more accurate as we go forward, particularly in the vertical delta M squared plane. So the measurement I'll tell you about that's new is the third phase, where we had these helium-3 filled detectors that we're referring to as neutral current detectors because they're primarily designed to observe that neutral current reaction. In other words, the free neutron that's produced. And in this case, what we're dealing with is an array of detectors that are a total of about 400 meters in length and which are capable of giving us a signal for a neutron that is totally independent of the light that's being produced and picked up by the phototube array that's surrounding them. In the past, when you're trying to separate out the charge current and neutral current signal, there's a fairly substantial correlation coefficient between them. If you just take the signals from the neutral current detectors, you have essentially no correlation between the signals. If you do a full analysis, including both the signals from the PMTs and the signals from the neutral current detector, you still have only a small correlation between them. And so you really have done quite an independent measurement. Not only that, in the case of having these helium-3 detectors in, you actually suppress the neutrons that are observed capturing on the heavy water as showing up as an interference with the charge current signal, whereas in the case of salt, you were enhancing it. And so it really is quite a different measurement that you're making. We made this measurement up until December 2006. The heavy water has now been removed, and I'll tell you about the future experiment when we replace the heavy water with liquid scintillator to do next generation of physics. This array of detectors is really quite remarkable in the sense that it used ultra-pure nickel, ironically using a technique developed by INCO, where you produce an organic compound of nickel and you heat it and you crack it onto a hot surface, same technique that's used to produce nickel cadmium batteries on a very large surface area. But in this case, we used it to produce quite substantial pieces of nickel that have nonetheless essentially no radioactivity in them because this organic material is formed easily for nickel, but not for the uranium and thorium impurities that are a problem in the experiment. And so we had parts in 10 to the 12th of uranium and thorium in our material. And we had this array of detectors that worked very well and gave us this signal. If you put in a neutron source, you see at about 700 kilovolts in the signal, you see this shape. that is well understood, well Monte Carloed in terms of what the response of the detector should be. You see that sitting on a background which looks like a big background. It turns out it's actually only about one count every 2 hours in 400 meters of detector. So you can see the sort of rates we're dealing with in this case. We, over a total of about a year and a quarter of running, we have about 1,000 events in this in these neutrons, and about three times that in the background underneath them. But that's enough to do quite an accurate measurement. The data analysis was this is blind data here. We blind ourselves so that we don't get led to the answer we had before by adding in additional signals that actually happen in our detector after a muon has struck near the detector. But we don't allow the analysts to know how much of that was added in. And we also throw away an unknown fraction of the data. So not until you've completed your analysis to find all your parameters do you, quote, open the blindness box and look at what your final result is, so that you do not get led towards a result that you might expect. And that works quite effectively in producing discipline in the analysts, let's say. A bit of suspense as well. And so this is what the data actually looks like. Beginning of May, we opened the blindness box, and our paper was put on the archive about 8 o'clock last evening. This is what the data looks like after the blindness is removed. It looks, of course, very similar to what you saw a moment ago. The alpha background plus some potential instrumental effects provide a background that looks like the green line. This is the shape that you get from your neutron calibration. The neutron background, calculated from a variety of sources, is only about 20% of the total, and it's known to about a little more than 10% in terms of its accuracy. The result of that, if you take that information and do a full analysis in which you also include the data for the photomultiplier tubes, then you find that the signal I showed you a moment ago is what you get from the neutral current detectors. This is what the data from the photomultiplier tubes looks like. Very little background. The background that we're dealing with here is down here in the in these little blue and green parts of the signal. This is the neutrinos as a function of energy as observed by the photomultiplier tubes. This is the part that is due to the charge current. This is the part that's due to the neutral current. And this is the angular distribution where the elastic scattering, as it happens, points directly away from the sun and can be extracted on that basis. This is what the data looks like for the neutral current detector part of the experiment. This is what it looked like when we had salt in there. And you'll see that here's the charge current in red in the two cases. In the case of the helium-3 detectors, the neutral current signal that's observed in the phototubes is suppressed because it's all being captured or largely being captured in the helium-3 detectors. When we had salt in there, it was being enhanced. And so you'll notice the ratio of the neutral current to charge current as observed by the PMTs is very different in the two experiments. Of course, the principal information on the neutral current comes from the helium-3 filled detectors themselves. And in fact, if you look at what the signals come out to be, this is the neutral current flux as observed in the different phases. This is for a situation where in the first case, we didn't have a very good definition of the neutral current signal because we didn't have that way of distinguishing it, which we did when we put the salt in through the pattern. But the salt and neutral and salt phase and the neutral current detector phase agree with each other very well and with similar accuracy. Charge current flux looks very similar through the phases. Elastic scattering flux, which has very big uncertainties on it in comparison to the others because there are few signals, actually is off by, more than about 2 standard deviations in this case. But overall, the consistency of the data, the probability for this to be consistent with statistics is 32%. And so this is, we think, a statistical fluctuation. If you now look, if you make the same plot as I made the last time, you get something that's very similar in terms of the ratio of charge current to a neutral current with a completely independent measurement. It agrees well with the Super-Kamiokande data. We are off with our own elastic scattering, but it has very little impact on the final results. So now if you look at the fits to neutrino oscillations, this is now what the total solar looks like. This is what solar plus CAMLAND from the 2005 data looks like. And in fact, what you find is that the values for delta M squared and theta are very similar, except that our previous value for theta had uncertainties of 2.4 or 2.2, and in this case, we're down to 1.4 and 1.3. But this will get even better when we include new data from CAMLAND, new data from Boroxino, and in fact, a low energy threshold analysis that we're pursuing on the preceding phases that will improve our results significantly in this uncertainty. Why do you want to do this? Well, we're testing models that go beyond the standard model by trying to incorporate massive neutrinos. There are some interesting phenomenology examples as to a difference between a couple of models. Tri-bimaximal mixing model would predict 35 degrees for this number. There are some models that have been put forward that note that theta 1,2 plus theta Kibibo is equal to approximately 45 degrees if theta 1,2 is 32.2. And so we're in a region where we're attempting to define such models. We will do a variety of other analyses as we go forward, and we have done a variety of different analyses on our data as well to try to exploit all the physics that we can get from it. Let me talk now about our new laboratory. This is a laboratory that is 2 kilometers underground and therefore is significantly deeper than any other laboratory that's presently in operation and can particularly do things where it has an advantage for experiments that benefit from a very deep and clean laboratory. Neutrinoless double beta decay, dark matter, and other experiments as well. We've had a set of experiments proposed for the laboratory that range through dark matter, neutrinoless double beta decay, and other physics. And we have built the laboratory. This is essentially all excavated now. The whole laboratory now is as clean as snow was. It's all class 2000. We have significantly better muon backgrounds than other laboratories, the major ones that are in operation now, and that helps considerably in these experiments. The future experiments now, I should say there are experiments that are in operation now, Picasso, which I'll tell you about later, and a liquid argon experiment at 7 kilogram level. There are planned experiments at a much larger level for liquid argon. There's a supernova watch experiment that is planned for this location. There are others in the other location, and we have just completed this cryopit, which is potential for a new, very large scale project, such as 50 to 100 tons for liquid argon or xenon. This is what it looks like up close. This is just finished in terms of excavation. These are essentially going to be ready for occupancy this year. These are big cavities. This shows you the sort of thing that we have. The walls are very carefully prepared and painted and can be made as clean as we made snow. So let me tell you a little bit about the experiments, a couple of the experiments we're planning to do, particularly a dark matter experiment where we hope to be in operation with about a ton of sensitive material by about 2010. We've been working our way towards it using the fact that liquid argon has a very different time profile for nuclear recoil, such as you would get from a WIMP hitting an argon nucleus, and the time profile, which is a much longer time if you have ionization from things such as betas or gammas, which are radioactivity in the vicinity. And if you take the ratio of the short time to the long time, then you have this prompt ratio, which looks like this for nuclear recoils and like this for ionization. And even though you have argon 39, which you want to discriminate at about 10 to the ninth in order to do the experiment, we have already been able to do that to 6 10 to the minus 8 and can extrapolate to a region where you can expect to have 10 to the 9th for a future experiment at the 1-ton scale. In fact, argon reduced in argon 39 has been found such that our discrimination level that we've obtained already would be adequate for that experiment. These are large experiments. By the time you've put in your liquid argon and your phototubes looking at them and surrounded them with water shielding to get one event per year background in the experiment. They fill up that cube hall, which is the largest of our chambers. However, the experimental limits can go several orders of magnitude below the present experimental limits for dark matter with the spin-independent sensitivity. Of course, we shouldn't forget the gamma signal, which is a big puzzle to everybody in the field. For double beta decay, you're dealing with a situation where if the neutrino is its own antiparticle, in other words, if they're Majorana particles, then you have a sensitivity to the phase space, to a nuclear matrix element, and to a quantity which is sensitive to all of those parameters I told you about earlier, which we essentially know by now. Neutrinoless double beta decay would give you a peak at the energy of emission of the electron, the two electrons summed together. That peak, if detected, would give you a sensitivity which right now, in terms of this effective mass, is up in the 0.5 electron volt region. This is the quantity that you get from neutrinoless double beta decay compared to the mass of the lightest neutrino using the parameters that you know about so far. This is roughly where the mass of the lightest neutrino has been disfavored by cosmology. We expect in the next generation of experiments to be down in this range. And that depends upon the hierarchy, which is defined for 1 and 2, but not yet for the others as yet. For snow, we're in a fortunate situation where if we replace the heavy water with liquid scintillator, we are able to build an experiment that requires little other change other than having 100 times the light output, roughly, and the ability to dissolve in that liquid scintillator neodymium compounds that would give us 56 kilograms of neodymium in the first place and up to 500 kilograms of neodymium if we are successful with a program that's going on in France to use a laser isotope separation for uranium, a facility that does that, to produce neodymium 150. We expect to have we're having a proposal that will be submitted this fall for about $12 million for this experiment to CFI, and we're hopeful that we would be able to start in 2010. There's other physics we can do using this greater light output to look at lower energy neutrinos and study the properties of such, well, I'll show you in a moment the physics we can do with it. Basically, all we have to do to snow in order to implement this is to hold down the central volume instead of holding it up, because the liquid scintillator is actually lighter than water as compared to the heavy water, which is obviously heavier. Otherwise, everything else is essentially usable. We have to have high purity liquid scintillator. If we do that, then you can see a bump here at a point where you have, in fact, obtained the purified, or rather the isotope enriched neodymium 150. At 3 times the present limit, you would see a bump that looked like this. In fact, we hope to be able to get down to the 0.04 electron volt limit in terms of sensitivity by counting for a few years. For studying PEP neutrinos, which we can do, and we may be uniquely able to do that because of our depth, you can also study the energy dependence of this electron transformation process of solar neutrinos reaching you. And look in a region where essentially the two terms in the MSW effect are canceling each other, and look for effects of other things like non-standard interactions or even mass-varying neutrinos. And so that will be other physics that we'll do in the future. If you use lead and the helium-3 detectors, you can study supernova in a way that's different from other detectors. If you use fluorine in the Picasso experiment, then you can study the spin-dependent interaction for detecting dark matter with good sensitivity. And they are already running 2 kilograms, 2.5 kilograms. They will be scaling that up. It's a rather scalable experiment where they observe a bubble produced by a nuclear recoil and very little sensitivity to beta and gamma radiation in comparison. They observe it by the acoustic signals. And so finally, in summary, we finished SNOW. We still have another year or so of analysis on other topics. SNOW Lab is essentially complete and ready to go. And we're excited about the physics we can do with SNOW Lab. Neutrinoless double beta decay, best sensitivity, we think, in the world for dark matter detection are fun things to be working on. And so the excitement of the laboratory is pretty strong. And there are a number of significant international collaborations that have been formed to pursue this. And finally, there's a list of my collaborators for the SNOW experiment. Thank you.
Questions?
Then let's thank Art for his very clear presentation again, for his exciting talk.